Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We all know that Black women played a pivotal role during the Civil Rights Movement, but how many of us can name leaders beyond Rosa Parks and Coretta Scott King? Despite their significant contributions to the movement, these women are left out of history books and mostly remain invisible to the larger public. Today's guest, Dr. Janet Duart Bell, shines a light on their achievements in her new book, Lighting the Fires of Freedom, African American Women in the Civil Rights Movement. She captures the stories of nine of these women, many now in their 90s, through wide-ranging conversations, and they share intimate accounts of incredible struggles for justice that resulted in profound social change. To tell us more about the women she calls servant leaders, Janet Duart Bell joins us today from New York. Hi, Janet. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be on your show.
Well, thank you so much. And I loved your book, learning about so many of these incredible women. I actually had the pleasure of working with Eileen Hernandez here in San Francisco. She was part of the Women's Intercultural Network. But so much of what you brought out in the interview, I never knew about her. So thank you for writing this. And Janet, before we dive in and talk about these nine amazing women, I'd like to talk about you, just to find out about your background and how you came up with this idea. So you grew up in Erie, Pennsylvania. You have Southern roots.
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that time.
Well, I was born in Erie, Pennsylvania in 1946, where my parents had migrated from, they were part of the Northern Migration, my mother from rural Arkansas, my father from rural Georgia, and they met in Erie. And I always like to tell this a little bit about my mother and my grandmother. My grandmother had three children, three daughters, and my mother was the youngest one. My mother was not able to go to school past the eighth grade because there was no high school for Black children except 100 miles away in Little Rock, Arkansas. Her two older sisters were able to go to school, and but my mother had to be held back because my grandparents had 35 acres. They were still tenant farmers, but they never got their 40 acres and a mule. So my mother was passionate about education. She only went to the eighth grade. My father only went to the third grade. He was taken out for cotton picking season and other agricultural activities. He was born in 1898.
Wow.
And so I always say, so of course I would become an educator, right? And a communication person. Because of the passion of my parents and the bravery that they and other people did for living in those kinds of times. My grandmother was 4'8", 100 pounds, less than 100 pounds. She could drag a 100-pound sack of cotton through the fields in 120-degree heat.
Wow.
And I say, that's the kind of legacy I have to live up to every day.
Wow. I love that there are photos of your mother, Millie Mae Brooks, and then your grandmother. Is it Sophronia?
Sophronia.
Thank you. Sophronia
McKnight.
That's
okay.
You tell this amazing story about your grandmother having to deal with white people who came to the area. I think they were selling insurance, and they hit on one of your aunts.
Yes. So in those days, and someone told me that still goes on now in some of the rural areas, the insurance people would come by once a week to collect the premiums, and they were always white. Now, remember, this was in rural Arkansas. So that one day an insurance man came and he fondled one of my grandmother's daughters, my aunt's, in front of her. And my grandmother, 4'8", less than 100 pounds, calmly walks over and picks up a shotgun and she aims it so that it just misses his ear. And the young man was smart enough to leave. But my grandparents, frightened for their daughters, sent their daughters away because they thought surely they would be lynched. But they stood their ground. They refused to leave. They would rather die than be a slave or be beholden to anything people call Jim Crow laws. They're really courageous people, my grandmother and my grandfather. But after a while, so a week went by, nothing happened. 2 weeks went by, nothing happened. And eventually, another young white insurance man came, looked at my grandmother, and said, "Aunt Sophronia," as if nothing had ever happened. My grandmother lived to be in her 80s.
Wow. And I'm guessing that story is still told to this day in your family.
Yes.
How did that affect your mom, who had a very fierce notion about freedom?
My mother really raised me to fly. She raised me to have wings. And she said that the world was such, she wanted to raise me and my siblings so that we would be comfortable in any kind of setting. She thought that was the definition of freedom, and that we wouldn't do it by ourselves, we would bring other people with us.
And your mother, for much of her life between the 1940s and the 1960s, worked as a housekeeper. She also cleaned motel rooms.
Yes, my brilliant, beautiful mother worked that way in hotels and motels, but that did not limit her mind, her ambition. She was self-educated. She was the smartest person I ever knew. She taught all of us to read when we were at a very young age. I learned to read before I was 4 years old. My mother was active in my schooling. She was a woman outside of her work environment. She was a leader in the community. She was elegant and refined, and she was always looking out for our neighbors as well as our own family. She was a remarkable person.
I was struck by this line, and I'd love for you to elaborate. You write that your mother was not active in church. She deemed church hypocritical and too formal.
Yes, and she also thought there was something wrong with an institution that elevated men while the women did most of the work.
It's so interesting for a woman in that place at that time to think that church was too hypocritical, because your mother was part of a lot of social clubs, and for so many people, church was like a social club.
Yes, my mother actually was not part of social clubs because we were poor. We lived in a poor, integrated area. When I grew up, I thought ethnics were Poles and Germans and Italians and what have you. And at that time, we were called colored Negroes, what have you. We were united by the fact that we were all poor. And my mother, because of our particular circumstances, was not invited to join some of to join any of these social clubs. So she became an active participant in the PTA and other things. Mm-hmm. And people at my school, there were very few black children in my school. In fact, my graduating class only had 2 because we lived on the border between the city and the county, and we could go to either county or city schools. And my mother chose, because of the educational opportunities, that we should go to the county schools. So, and that's where I went.
In your graduating class, it was about 1,300 students?
Yes. Well, the whole school, I misstated that once. There were about 1,300 in the whole school, and there were several hundred in my graduating class, and there were only 2 blacks. Both of us were girls.
And what was that experience like for you?
Besides being quite interesting, what it was is that there were no special rules for us. So, for example, we in some of the large urban schools, they tracked students, and which is a terrible kind of system to keep people in secondary kind of educational systems. In my school, because there were so few of us, we competed on the same basis with everybody else. There was no special tracking. The only thing was you were as good as you could be, and I competed right along with the guys. I was the secretary, then the president of the debate society, things like that. So I got a first-rate, may I say, public education.
It's really incredible. And then I also read that you were president of the NAACP youth chapter when you were only 12 years old.
Yes. My mother, I told you she taught us to read she taught me to read when I was 4. And she believed in just doing it, and that you had a responsibility to do as much as you could, to learn as much as you could, to move forward. You know, that was the time when so much was happening in terms of our country, so much optimism as to the chance of our country really achieving these great ideals that we espouse.
Wow, it's incredible. President of your NAACP youth chapter when you were 12 and just one of two black students in your high school.
Yes, but I was also, because my mother wanted to make sure that I was culturally grounded, even though she didn't go to church. It's very interesting. My father went to church. In fact, he was a deacon. So my mother encouraged us to do things at church, to do things in various clubs, and we did that. I was in the Brownies. I couldn't get in Girl Scouts because they did not want black children in Girl Scouts. So I find it interesting that the Girl Scouts later on is very integrated, and actually the National Girl Scouts was much more integrated than the Erie, Pennsylvania one. My scouting ended as a Brownie.
You know, this is so interesting because you write about the Girl Scouts, the YWCA, wanting to go to the roller skating rink and not being allowed to, and then talking about this with your parents and having to make a decision about what to fight. Do you want to spend your time fighting to get into the roller skating rink, fighting to go swimming, fighting to be a Brownie? Can you talk about the conversations you had with your parents about that?
Well, actually, that particular incident was from Dr. June Jackson Christmas. And she talks about the sitting down at the bowling alley, that they wanted to go on strike because teenagers, I always think about how these young, even though I interviewed people when they were mature like me or sometimes older than I am, there were several of my contemporaries, which means we were about in the 68-70 range, but several of the women are 90s, as we say, with years of untold stories. But Dr. June Jackson Christmas from Boston, she talked about how her father, who was trying to go up in the post office, and after several exams where he was the first one, the absolute top person, was not selected as a supervisor, and the kinds of troubles he had. But he thought that she should really pay attention to specific kinds of things, that you cannot fight every kind of issue. Mm-hmm. And at first she was very disappointed in her father with that, and then later on she understood that you have to pick your fights. Later she was one of the first African Americans to graduate from Vassar College, and while she was there, this is interesting, she, the only black student, organized other students, she, the only black student in her group, to champion the cause of interned Japanese Americans during World War II, and she goes to the dean. They go to the dean. The dean says, "Well, you know, we can't just have scholarships for Japanese Americans." And then they thought, "Well, can you have scholarships for people who are displaced because of relocation during World War II?" And the dean thought, "Well, yeah, that makes sense." So she found a way to work around the system. And so that to me is the kind of ingenuity that a lot of these women had. Later on, she got her MD. She's a psychiatrist. She and her husband, Walter Christmas, hosted groups of civil rights workers in their big townhouse here in New York City, where she did counseling and fundraising support and other kinds of activities. She's absolutely a remarkable person, as are the other eight people in the book.
Yes, my apologies, Janet. I took so many notes from your book.
They just got
messed up. I mean, these stories are so incredible. Let's talk a little bit about how you decided to take on this issue. You've got some interesting stories about your college years and why you decided to withdraw from Howard University in your sophomore year and become involved in the civil rights movement in 1966.
Yes, well, I say that writing this book was either, so people ask me, how long did it take you to write the book? And the answer is either all my life or 2 years. Because it's something that I've been passionate about a lot. But I really say that the book is my part of the book is the introduction and the introduction to the chapter. But what really, I think, makes the book sing are the stories of these women and the fact that they would be so generous in terms of talking about their experiences and to provide the kinds of insight that we need today. And it's just exciting to me to talk to these women. And the thing about them is that I always say that they're not museum pieces to be dusted off in February for Black History Month or March in Women's History Month, but these are women who've lived vital lives. So from the time of whatever their involvement might be in the Civil Rights Movement, they've remained active their whole life. Mm. With the only one woman has died since I started this book, and that's Eileen Hernandez, as you mentioned earlier. And she has a couple of great stories. Well, as she recalls being a student activist at Howard University in Washington, D.C. And I have to remind particularly younger people that Washington, D.C. was segregated. Mm. It was part of this segregated South. So Eileen Hernandez and her other student activists were doing the same kinds of things under less threat of violence as the people in the Deep South. And I always lift up and say that the people who worked in the heart of the Civil Rights Movement in the Deep South, I call it the cauldron of the Civil Rights Movement, those are the people who their bravery is without peer. But others had their part. And part of my observation of the Civil Rights Movement and of these women is that people played the different parts, and that I wanted to talk about how you can lead. It started off as really evolved from my dissertation, which was on leadership and change. And my theory of change is that leadership comes from all levels. You can lead from the middle of the pack. And sometimes that's a very powerful thing. So you have instances that I don't write about extensively because they're not part of these nine women, but you have cooks who raised money to support the bus boycott and things like that. Mm-hmm. So people found a niche, and they didn't wait to be assigned. They said, what can we do for the struggle? And they figured it out, and they made contributions without. They didn't wait to be lauded. They didn't wait to be named. My mother would say they did not stand on ceremony. They simply did the work that needed to be done.
Janet Dewart Bell is a social justice activist with a doctorate in leadership and change from Antioch University. She founded the Derrick Bell Lecture on Race in American Society series at the New York University School of Law. And we're talking with Dr. Janet Dewart Bell today about her new book, Lighting the Fires of Freedom, African American Women in the Civil Rights Movement. And she shines a light on the achievements of nine women, many now in their 90s, through wide-ranging conversations. And if you have any questions or comments for today's guest, Janet Dewart Bell, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. How did you choose these particular nine women?
Well, I wanted to get a diversity of leadership. That was one thing that I set out to do. And then, very frankly, it's part of who you have a list, and you try to get certain people, and I got the people that I needed to get. It's sort of like when people show up at a meeting and they wonder about the people who aren't there. It's the people who are there who are the most important, and the people who are here. I didn't think I was going to get Kathleen Cleaver, to be honest.
Hmm. Why not?
But I said, oh, because she's Kathleen Cleaver, and she's when I first met her, I was one of those unnamed people in the background. Same with Diane Nash. I was one of those unnamed people, and I thought, well, she's Kathleen Cleaver, and I'm not. I was intimidated by her, to be honest. Here's someone who's the first woman to serve on the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. When I speak in public, especially to young people, I say she was the real Black Panther. And she spent 4 years in exile in Algeria and Korea. She then came back. She graduated from Yale University, summa cum laude, went on to Yale Law School, then clerked for a judge. She's now a law professor. When I interviewed her, she was so sweet and kind. She allowed me to come into her home where her grandchildren were visiting from the Sudan, and she devoted much time talking with me. Now, those people who are grandparents understand how precious that time is, mm-hmm. that she would give that to someone who's virtually a stranger. But she had things to say that she said maybe in different places. But one thing that's wonderful about the interview with her, she talked about growing up in Tuskegee, Alabama, which was really kind of a cocoon for black people, where you had a lot of educated people, but she also went abroad with her father, who was involved in international agricultural development. So she lived as a young child in countries where people of color were in charge. And so she said, white supremacy never had a chance with me. It was over before it started. Bam.
Hmm.
She was wonderful.
She also told you, as you were talking about, while she was in Sierra Leone, where her father was stationed, kids there asked her what was wrong with her people, black people in the U.S., and why they let people walk all over them. How did those experiences shape her philosophies and ultimately her views as she got older?
Well, trying to interpret what she said, and I always say I try to go back to the words of the women, because the whole point is really to lift up their voices and their insights. But I think a lot of times their various experiences, like you'd asked me earlier about my educational experiences, you don't feel them necessarily at the time, but they do shape you, and they shape you to know that's you make a decision between what is real and what isn't, and how you can make a contribution. So I think her conscious contribution to go from a student, she worked a little bit for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee before she went to the Black Panther Party. I think all of that was part of the environment, part of the atmosphere.
What struck you?
I have to say this.
Sure.
I asked her how she became a leader, and her response was, because I was there. And at first when she said it, I thought, oh, my. But then I understood that. You take the place where you are, and you're rooted there, and you grow from there. And so her because I was there became much more profound to me than when she first said it to me.
She also said, I was trained from the time I was 3 years old in a community in which the challenge to segregation was very alive. My father was mm-hmm. very much a part of it. My mother was very much a part of it all before I was born. And then he goes to the Foreign Service and I go out of the United States. So I'm totally moved from any socialization tips except this reaction to racism that my parents would have done anyway.
And her brilliant mother, who graduated from college at some ridiculously young age, I can't remember, 16 or 17, something like that.
What struck
yes.
you about the what she described about her time in SNCC in the summer of 66?
Can you say,
when she came to SNCC in the summer of 66, mm-hmm. what struck
right.
you about her descriptions of that time and her experiences?
I think it's just a part of the formative experience, getting more information. But it really didn't strike me as a particularly, given her other experiences, that didn't stand out to me as one of the most significant. Now, she may totally disagree with me. Judy Richardson, on the other hand, her movement experience is SNCC. Hmm. That was not the same for Kathleen Cleaver.
And the Black Power movement, I mean, we could talk about her just the entire hour.
We could talk about any of them.
Of any of them, I know. I mean, what was it about that struck her? And when did you interview her? Because you interviewed these women at different times over the last, what, 5, 10 years?
Over the last 5 or 6 years.
Okay.
Yes, not 10 years. And I interviewed all of them before the election of 2016. I get a question sometimes, what do they think now? And someone said when I was speaking last week, they said, well, are you going to go back and interview them again? I said, if they would give me the time, it would be great to see if they had any change, if they had any further insights using their experience and what have you, to as to where the country is right now. But I interviewed Kathleen Cleaver, I believe it was about 5 years ago.
Yeah, that would be amazing to interview them again, especially with what we're facing right now. We're going to take a quick break. We're joined by Janet Dewart-Bell talking about her new book, Lighting the Fires of Freedom, African-American Women in the Civil Rights Movement. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by Dr. Janet Dewart Bell, a social justice activist with a doctorate in leadership and change from Antioch University. And we're talking with her about her new book, Lighting the Fires of Freedom: African American Women in the Civil Rights Movement. Dr. Bell shines a light on the achievements of nine incredible women, some now in their 90s, through wide-ranging conversations. Unfortunately, so many Black women who played a pivotal role during the Civil Rights Movement are not in our history books and remain invisible to the larger public. But now we have stories of nine of these incredible women, including Eileen Hernandez, Judy Richardson, Gay McDougall, Gloria Richardson, in this new book, Lighting the Fires of Freedom. And if you have a question or comment for Dr. Janet Dewart Bell, or if there is a woman in the civil rights movement that you think deserves more attention and maybe wasn't in your history book, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And this is the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. There's been a lot of media attention around it. What are your thoughts about all, gosh, there's so many new documentaries out about MLK, a lot of new series about this time. What are your thoughts about the stories that are being told specifically about women, the untold stories? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Janet, let's talk about Diane Nash. You have said this is one of the hardest interviews you've ever done. Why is that? Yes.
Well, because Diane Nash is very precise. That is the source of her brilliance, and that was the key to her activism. She led the Nashville student movement and the Freedom Ride. She took over when the Congress on Racial Equality was violently attacked, and so she is a strategist and a tactician. She's just wonderful person, and she always uses the term diligence. She became head of the Nashville student movement after there were two other people who preceded her, I believe, and they were both guys, and they would come back to report to the community, and they were not precise enough. Now, remember how dangerous this was. Mm. People were living in bold-faced American terrorism, and so the community members, and Diane Nash thought that this was not good enough, so they asked her, they moved her in that leadership position, and she was, of course, there and ready to take that. She probably speaks more passionately about nonviolence than almost anybody else I've ever interviewed. But one of the things she said, if we allowed violence to stop the move, to stop us at this point, you know, then that the things, you know, the movement would be over. And she was just, she was incredible. The reason she was tough to get is that she didn't really know me, and I had to go around and get someone whom she did know who could vouch for me that I was not, that I would tell her story, allow her to tell her story the way she wanted to. So the late Ivanhoe Donaldson, who just died a year or so ago, interceded for me. And Diane Nash said to me that she would give me, she was the shortest interview that I did, but she was also the most organized person. She's the kind of person you put a mic in front of, you say what the topic is, and then you just sort of be quiet and let her go through, because she's that organized. But she's also authentic. She thinks about the question. She's just fast as can be. But she was the hardest one, because I had to get someone else to really intercede. And when I called her, she wanted to do the interview by phone. She was in Chicago, I was in New York City, and I said okay, although my preference was always to go to interview people in person. Mm. Because I thought that would be I at least audio taped them, and when I was able to, I also did several videotapes. But Diane Nash would only do this by phone, and she said, "Well, I'll give you 15 minutes," and I said, "Okay." And so she was talking. She beautiful interview, and of course I'd read everything about her that I could, and so I looked at my stopwatch and I said, "Oh," I said, "Miss Nash, I said, it's been, I said, I don't want to impose. It's been 15 minutes. And she said, just matter of fact, no hostility whatsoever. She said, it's been 18 minutes. And I thought that was so wonderful, because what I like about these women, they have their own personality. They are authentic. They are not cookie cutter heroines. Mm. You can't just pick one out and substitute that person for the other. They are very distinct. They bring bring very distinct perspectives to their work, and they're wonderful. So the other thing, the follow-up with Diane Nash, is that just before the book was going to press, she didn't know what the schedule was, because it had been some time since they interviewed her, and she said, you know, I'd really like to correct something that's in there. She said, I've let it stand for 50 years. And she said, I know where you got it. And almost every, if you read about her, they will say that she and others had their wills made before the Freedom Ride, and that's not exactly what happened. What happened was, now remember how precise she is, what she wanted to have corrected is that several of the Freedom Riders gave her sealed envelopes to deliver to their family in case they needed to do that. And that is a distinction that was important to her, so it was important to me, and I essentially didn't tell her, well, you know, we're really going to press in 3 days, but we were able to make that change, and I think that is a wonderful thing, and I think that what I'm not sure I got everything right, but I really tried to get everything right in terms of these women. I wanted to honor them and respect them. And clearly, I fell in love with every one of them.
You know, Janet, that is so interesting, because sometimes we'll have people on the show. Well, you, for example, I watched a few interviews that you've done. I've read some articles, and you see things that are repeated over and over again. And I'll put that in the interview and ask someone a question, and they'll say, actually, that's not right. And I'll say, but it was printed 4 different times, but it doesn't always mean it's right. So that's really fascinating, because that really struck me when I read the Diane Nash interview, that she got the sealed envelopes from Freedom Riders. Mm-hmm. Did this happen in any other interview where someone said, you know what, that's been printed so many times, but it's just not accurate?
I haven't seen that. That's not to say that it doesn't exist, but I have not seen that. But she was but it was interesting. She got in touch with me and said, I know why you said it that way, but I'd like to change it. And that's the way she is. She's very precise. She's very genteel. And even when she was asked by the federal government not to continue this dangerous Freedom Ride, she did it with that same grace and steely determination.
Another line really struck me. She told you, quote, when I obeyed segregation rules, I felt like I was agreeing to my own inferiority.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that really also stood out for me. You know, the other thing is, there's so many parallels in a lot of the interviews you did, whether it was, what fight should I take on, even as a young person? Try to go swimming, try to go roller skating, try to become a brownie. I mean, can you talk a little bit about some of the parallels that came out? Because that one really stood out for me. Like, what is the fight here? Dad says no, Mom says yes, go for it.
That's a very good question, and no one ever asked me that question before, so I took a moment just to think about it. I think the parallels, well, first of all, I had a core group of questions, because I wanted to compare avocados to avocados, right? Mm-hmm. So you have a core group of questions, but you don't stick to that, and you let people take off from there. So there is a little bit of comparison, like what were your early influences, things like that. But I think when I look at it, it's there's a theme of education, there's a theme of community, there are themes of community service, the themes of if not me, then who? In this, for example, Gay McDougall, who was the first African American to integrate the all girls Agnes Scott College, which is outside of Atlanta. And can you imagine being the only one for 2 years? After 2 years, she transferred to Bennington College. She later became an anti-apartheid leader, and she She really was very involved in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. She led demonstrations and strategy sessions in Washington, D.C., where she met her late husband, John Peyton, who's wonderful. She became a MacArthur Fellow. She very involved in human rights. So human rights is the theme that she pushes. She was the first to be elected to oversee the United Nations International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. And recently, just this year, Agnes Scott College commissioned a painting of her and a symposium named after her. And we smiled. I've seen her a couple times this year and say, well, I guess times do change just a little bit. But there's a picture of her in there with Nelson Mandela, where he voted for the first time. That is a very famous photo, and that shows you her importance to that struggle.
Wow, that was in 1994.
1994. I remember it well. I was screaming. I was so happy.
Wow. Well, see, this is interesting. I'm looking at this picture, and there's Nelson Mandela with three men in the background, and then Gay is to his right. And, you know, and you wonder, well, who is that woman? And, you know, is she in many history books, to your knowledge?
To my knowledge, no. She's not often mentioned. She's mentioned more over the last couple of years or so. And I think now that it's interesting, some of these schools now who did not want black people there, like Agnes Scott and Vassar, reluctantly, believe it or not, they didn't run out and recruit a whole bunch. They're now acknowledging, Swarthmore, where Judy Richardson went. She's been honored by Swarthmore. She's been honored by the city of Boston. And it's interesting how it comes around a little bit. What I appreciate about them is that they accept the acknowledgement and they accept the, in some cases, almost adulation, but they are not swayed by that. By that I mean that they realize that no matter what they've done, that they want to do more. It's amazing.
Today we're speaking with Janet Dewart Bell about her new book, Lighting the Fires of Freedom, African-American Women in the Civil Rights Movement. Unfortunately, so many amazing women who were instrumental in the civil rights movement are not in our history books, and most people do not really know them by name. And Janet Dewart Bell shines a light on their achievements. She interviewed 9 of these women. Many are now in their 90s. She had wide-ranging conversations with them, and they shared intimate accounts of incredible struggles for justice that resulted in profound social change. Let's talk next about your first interview. This one was really fun to read because it was about food and New Orleans. Let's talk about Leah Chase.
Leah Chase is just as sweet as she can be. She's tall, she's stately, she's still cooking in her restaurant at the age of 95. When I interviewed her, I think she was a young 90. And the reason she's there, remember I talked about leadership in all different levels, she and her husband at their family restaurant, Dookie Chase Restaurant, which many of us go to, she's now considered the queen of Creole cuisine, a title which I smile every time I see that. But what she calls is she just did what she did best. That was cooking and bringing people together over good food and providing an atmosphere of warmth and caring. Now, this may seem like something nice that your mother or you or auntie would have on Sunday afternoon, but remember, this was in the segregated South. Her business, the family business, could have been shut down or raided because she hosted interracial gatherings, which by their very nature were in defiance of segregation. But the family was held in such regard that they were not shut down. And she thinks it's partly it was due to New Orleans, joie de vivre, what do they call it? Laissez le bon temps rouler, right? Let the good times roll. So she says she said they had a more genteel kind of segregation, but it was segregation nonetheless. And that it was necessary to fight to break down these barriers. The other thing that she says is that we should have listened to these young people earlier. We should have listened to them more. And she expresses some regret for not having supported the young people. She's talking about the young people in SNCC and other groups who were involved in protesting segregation, protesting Jim Crow laws. She's a wonderful person. Her restaurant was almost destroyed during Hurricane Katrina, and she lived in a FEMA trailer until her restaurant was rebuilt. Her son had the foresight to, when the floods came, to take from their walls their wonderful collection of African American art. At one time, she had one of the largest collections in the country, and she collected it not as a collector, but as a way to provide another benefit to the community. So the wonderful thing is that art was saved. It's back on the walls where it belongs. And she's the character for the princess. Princess Tiana,
right.
I believe
yes.
that is. Yes.
Yeah, that was interesting to read.
She's the inspiration, yes.
The other thing that was so interesting to read in some of these interviews is to learn about how parents talk to these young girls about segregation. And in the case of Leah Chase, she said that they knew that they couldn't eat at certain places because they were black, but parents never said mm-hmm. that. They didn't tell us that. She said they covered it up. Well, you can't sit in this fine seat in the theater. It's not good anyway, because look how much better you can see if you're sitting up high. And she said, I'll never forget that. Right, in the balcony. And she said, I want to sit down there. It looks good. No, you can see better up here. These are the kinds of things her parents did to shelter her in those days.
Well, many people were sheltered, not just the girls, but the boys.
Right.
When you talk about how do you get people, and part of it is you tell your children things that are age appropriate, right? And as they get older, you have the conversation we talk about that you tell you tell black boys, for example, in New York, don't fall asleep on the subway.
Right.
I mean, things like that. But you know, when you're 5 and 6 years old or going into puberty, there are different kinds of conversations that you have to shield your children, but also to be realistic, because there's a world that they're facing that's outside of the family that is protecting them.
That it was just so interesting to see how parents made those decisions and what they told their kids. Janet Duart Bell is author of Lighting the Fires of Freedom, African American Women in the Civil Rights Movement. Janet, we have about 5 minutes left, and let's talk just briefly to kind of bring it to where we are today about Gloria Richardson. This is really interesting because you interviewed Gloria Richardson in her New York City apartment with the television showing a news report of young black activists protesting police brutality.
Mm-hmm. And she was just as she was articulate, she had great insight, and she had that kind of righteous anger that she's always had. And she talked about the need to be aware of societies, that society changes, but it doesn't always change in the way that we want it to, and it certainly doesn't change fast enough. But she was totally in support of Black Lives Matter.
Mm. She helped lead the Cambridge Movement, a civil rights struggle in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yes.
When she went to the March on Washington to speak and she got on stage, the microphone was snatched from her hands?
I don't think I said that. She was actually late because she was looking for someone else. So she doesn't make too big an issue of that. I mean, I have the incident in the book, but that doesn't loom as a major issue that she talks about. What she does talk about, and it's so funny because I have so much more material than I wrote in the book that sometimes I have to remember what I included. But one of the things that she did talk about was the lack of women speaking at the March on Washington. But she was called, the Ebony magazine called her the Lady General of Civil Rights, because she did not believe, or she questioned the use of nonviolence, but she accepted it as a tactic, but she questioned it as a philosophy, unlike Diane Nash, who passionately believes in nonviolence.
Mm. As you said, Janet, you know, obviously you can't paint all of these women with one brush. I mean, they all come
right.
from different backgrounds and have very different opinions about about what they dealt with, the successes, the lessons. But when you look, I mean, it would be amazing to have them on to talk about where we are right now. When you look at where we are today with Confederate statues coming down and really a very intense conversation around race, thankfully, because we have video cameras on our phones, we are now seeing, everyone is seeing what so many of us have experienced. And for example, people staying in a home with Airbnb, three black women, and then the neighbor calls the cops. A young Yale student sleeps in a common room, and a white student calls the cops. The two men at Starbucks, and they're the worker calls the cops. I mean, how, when you interviewed these women, this is a very big question, but when you interviewed these women, and then you sit back and think about where we are today, what would you say really stands out for you in making sense of this?
What stands out for me is that the contributions of these women were great, legion, but they could have been so much more had they not been, had their lives not been hampered by segregation, by racism, by sexism, by knowing that they are as good, or in some cases superior to most of us, and not being able to exercise that, not to be, and they don't necessarily consider it, they don't dwell on the loss, as I, sort of stepping back as an observer and trying, and a little bit of a scholar, I look at the loss to our society. It's interesting, you didn't mention Merle Evers, but I want to lift her up because Mrs. Evers says that she spent much of her life with people saying, oh, she's just Medgar Evers' wife or Medgar Evers' widow. She was not just anything. She was a leader in her own right. She and Medgar Evers were absolute partners. They loved each other dearly. She, when her husband was assassinated in their driveway, essentially in front of her and their three young children, she went on and created a life for herself, a life that continued to be a life of meaning and worth. And she graduated from college. She went to college at the age of 31. She got her bachelor's. She had a professional career. She reinvigorated the NAACP. She continued to fight for justice for the murder of her husband. And you know, the thing that's amazing, everybody knew who did it. Mm-hmm. All the black people, all the white people. You could not convict him for decades until he was finally convicted. I try not to mention his name in 1994. But these women just took it upon themselves that whatever their burdens were, whatever their challenges were, they found a way to overcome those. And I say that very, very seriously. They would use their own ingenuity. They were all to a person culturally grounded. And by that I meant they found solace in whatever the experiences of the African American community were. And I think that some of our young people today miss that because they've been given the lie that we are post-racial and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I spoke to a group of young people a couple of years ago, and they were telling me, but no, we're post-racial. I said, close your eyes. And I said, what color am I? To a person, they said, black. I said, so let's have this post-racial conversation again. Mm. I said, but that shouldn't be, that's not an excuse. That's just a reality that you have to look at. You have to know what the problem is in order to change it, in order to find a solution.
Janet Dewart Bell is author of Lighting the Fires of Freedom, African American Women in the Civil Rights Movement. Janet, thank you so much for telling these amazing stories, and thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I'm delighted. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.